Okay, I see. So anyway, our first topic tonight is the Debian OpenSSL vulnerability. Yeah, what happened? Some Debian hackers modified some OpenSSL code, and this resulted in a huge vulnerability. So our topic tonight is, what is that vulnerability? How did it manifest itself? And what are the impacts? Yeah, I have two studio guests here. Alech from Darmstadt, who works for a security company who secures systems, and he has a well, he knows a lot about this vulnerability because he had to deal with it live. Hi, Alech, can you hear me?
Yeah. Finally, I can hear you.
Well, I can't hear you. Okay, so now Alech can hear me and I can hear him. Yeah, hi, Alech.
Hi, Herzi.
So, you work for a security company. Can you tell us what you do in your everyday work?
Typically, so I work at a very small security company, and I do lots of consulting there. And what I mostly do is PKI, so public key infrastructure work. We're actually building an open source PKI, so that is the most part of my work that I actually work on the open source PKI. And if I get the time for it, typically like one day a week or so, I do some security research on PKI and crypto related stuff mostly.
Okay, so you were directly affected by this Debian SSL vulnerability.
Luckily, we weren't that much affected. We only had a few smaller problems at a customer, and of course, the servers at our company a bit. But as we're a very small company, that was resolved very quickly. I know people who have been affected far
Okay,
worse.
so can you explain us what actually happened? What went wrong?
So what went wrong is the Debian maintainer at some point did some check on the OpenSSL source, and they were looking at the OpenSSL source with some automated tools, and then the tools complained that they were using some kind of uninitialized data there. And so he thought, well, it doesn't really work with the uninitialized data. We can probably uncomment that. And he actually did that, and actually he even asked it upstream if that was okay. And upstream said, yeah, the uninitialized data doesn't add entropy anyways, so it was adding data to an entropy pool. And basically they said it wouldn't hurt to do that. Unluckily, he actually uncommented that in two places, so nearly the same code was in two places. And in one place it was perfectly okay to uncomment it. It wouldn't have broken anything. And actually, in the other place, that was the only place where entropy was really added. So the function took some data that would have been added to the entropy pool. And well, after the patch, it really didn't add any data to the entropy pool. So basically, the remaining entropy that was left in the Debian package was then only from the pit.
Okay, so the entropy pool was too small. So this resulted in only a few random numbers being generated. And you need the random numbers to generate the keys, right?
Yeah, basically that's not the only place, but you need the random numbers for nearly everything. So you need to generate the keys with that. But Debian, of course, uses OpenSSL in a lot of places, not only in OpenSSH, which was the main affected thing, I guess, but all over the place. And every time where you took some random data there from OpenSSL, basically, that was flawed because there are only like 32,000 random values that are available on a Debian machine at that point if you had that vulnerable version.
Okay, so they changed it in a generic library that is used by a lot of programs.
Yeah, true.
Okay, so when did this happen?
That actually happened, I don't remember the exact date, but somewhere in 2006, I think in the middle of 2006.
Oh, 2006, so this is really quite some time ago.
Yeah. So it's been going on a while, and of course, a lot of people have generated keys and have used that for doing some things with cryptography, and basically all of that is broken now.
Okay, so a lot of people used that, and I think some people said at the last Congress in Berlin in December that there was a vulnerability in SSH, so it is known for quite some time now. Why didn't they announce this earlier? Was it did they still build a exploit or?
I don't know. I haven't heard that actually at the Congress. I haven't heard people talking that there was a vulnerability in SSH. But if they knew, then that's a pretty good question why they didn't announce it. I think probably, I mean, it was found by some Debian developer that actually made the security announcement in the first place. And I think the Debian project probably wasn't aware of that until then. And then, well, they can be blamed that they actually checked in the code, and then 5 days later they made the security announcement, which, yeah, was of course a problem, because then people already knew, because it had been checked into the source code system.
Oh, okay. So they had 5 days to actually exploit this on real life machines.
Yeah, and if you look, there's some interesting statistics that is linked at some pages, where people have some kind of automated packet blocking for SSH devices. So if you have an SSH and you've got that software running, it recognizes if you are being attacked, and then it blocks that on the firewall. And you can see that that's sort of collaborative, and you can see from the statistics from them that there's been a huge peak in blocking of connection attempts during that time, just shortly after the release in the code. And before actually releasing the security advisory. So, yeah.
So I these were probably the Debian people themselves who did the tests.
You never
only
know.
Only to evaluate how many people are affected.
I wouldn't really guess that. I think really people read the code and the revision control system,
okay,
check-in, so and actually started to exploit that.
So you think this hole was known to a huge audience before it was announced to the general public?
I wouldn't say a huge audience, but I guess there must be some people who actually read those check-ins. And I actually know that there are people who are actually being employed to read that for a living. So of course, that makes sense that they must have known that before the advisory was published.
Okay, this probably includes some people who would do use their knowledge for evil purposes.
It seems so, yeah.
Okay, so what is the exact impact of this hole?
Yeah, the exact impact is basically all you've been doing during that time. So if somebody sniffed that, say you've got your system patched now, of course the first thing is to patch your system, because otherwise you'd be vulnerable to a lot of things. I mean, if you use public keys to authenticate to your server, then if you've got a vulnerable public key in there, then somebody else can authenticate using that key, because as I said, there are only like 32,000, and you can just brute force that against the server and see if somebody has an authorized key in his root account, for example. And say that is fixed, of course, you still got the problem that if you've used it in the past, you might still be vulnerable if somebody sniffed all your traffic. And I think that might have happened to a lot of people who are listening as well. I mean, you've all been to a security conference, so I guess a lot of people listening, I've been to security conferences, and I'd be surprised if nobody sniffed SSH traffic there. I mean,
It seems likely. Yeah. But it doesn't only affect SSH, it also affects SSL, which is used for, among others, securing communication to your online banking sites.
True, yeah. So the SSL part, I mean, when the vulnerability advisory, the advisory security advisory was first released, they had only a tool to check for weak keys, for weak SSH keys. And nobody had actually prepared a list of vulnerable certificates or public keys that are used in the SSL case, because there is a slight difference between the keys used in the SSH keys and the keys used for SSL. Actually, that's just the public exponent. They have got a different exponent there, so you've got different keys, and you can use the tool that they developed for checking SSH keys to check that against SSL keys.
Oh, okay. Do you know of any important certificates that are affected?
Yeah, actually I do. So what happened there was I came into work the Wednesday when the advisory was published, and my boss and I had both read it, and we decided that working in PKI, we of course have to look at the certificate side of things, and that we had to generate a list of all the public keys that are being used in certificates. And we actually did that on Wednesday, and well, the computing actually finished on Thursday. And so Thursday morning we started to check. Well, first of all, we checked the CAs, because the certificate authorities, that would have been the worst case if a certificate authority would have been compromised. And basically you could have impersonated every site that is possible on the whole net, because the CA would have been trusted in a browser. So we checked the CAs first, and luckily none of them were affected. It was a wild guess. I mean, luckily most of them actually use random hardware number generators and stuff like that. So
okay.
It's pretty secure.
So they would still be secure if they use Debian on their systems?
Yeah, they would be secure if they use Debian, if they were using a hardware device to do all their cryptography work, which at a decent CA, that is what people do.
Okay, so I assume that a lot of people use Debian also to generate root certificates, right?
Luckily, I guess not that many. To really do root certificates, if you've got a decent organization that puts some money into that.
What do you use, FreeBSD?
No, actually, at the customer where we mostly work to do that, we're actually using Zuse. Not that we particularly like it, but we're being forced to use it because that's the company policy there. But to actually generate those certificates, we're using what they call HSM, hardware security modules. So we're using hardware in that case as well. And hopefully that has been looked at very, very, very well. So people have looked at that. People say that would be much more secure than a typical Debian installation. But back to the SSL maybe. We've looked at the CAs and none of them were affected, and then of course I started looking at interesting SSL sites, I'd say. So I looked at a lot of banks first. So I looked at Wikipedia and found a list of the biggest banks in the world, and then I looked at a few banks in Germany. And actually, at that point, I found the website of a major German bank to be vulnerable. That was pretty interesting moment. You look at your screen and it says, "Oh, vulnerable." I was like, "Okay." Luckily, my boss knew somebody from their security team, so he called them up and he said, "Are you sitting down?" And he said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Oh, that's good, because we know the private key for your web server." And it was pretty funny. Everybody in the room was laughing, but of course, it's not that funny in the end, because even though they replaced the certificate pretty quickly, so that was 2 or 3 hours later, that was fixed. Everybody who got that certificate every black hat who got that certificate might not use it for phishing attempts, and that might still be interesting.
Okay, let's explain this a little in detail. Mm-hmm. So you get this vulnerable certificate and you have access to the public key and to the generic information that is shared between the public key and the private key, which you can then use to guess the private key because the random data is not...
Yeah,
random
you can.
Enough.
As you only have about 32,000 private keys for one key size and for one public exponent, you can just compute all the private public key pairs, which was what we did on Wednesday and Thursday. And then, of course, you've got the list, and then you can just look up the public key that is contained in the certificate, and then you've got the corresponding private key. So you could set up a web server that responds to with that URL, and that would be perfectly valid.
Okay, so the key was available for 3 hours after the vulnerability was published.
No, quite a bit more. I mean, it was available for 3 hours after we reported that, and that was already on Thursday evening or so. And I think in German time the vulnerability was published Tuesday evening or so. Somebody actually at the Chaos Treff told me about it on Tuesday evening already. So
that
was on quite a while.
In any case, the key was available much longer because they used it for quite a while before.
Sure.
The,
yeah.
Are these certificates cached locally?
Normally not, no. So you'd have to actually grab that certificate, so you wouldn't have it in your browser or cache or something if you connected to that site. But if you were looking for it, or if for some reason you had a crawler that went around crawling SSL web servers, you might still get hold of that certificate.
So probably the right people still have access to them, and they probably circulate in the right circles, right?
I don't know anything about that, being in those circles, but well, you might guess that people actually started crawling the minute that the advisory hit it, and people who understood what was happening and what that implied to the advisory certainly went away and started getting all the keys that they could get hold of, I guess.
Okay, so they replaced the certificate, they probably revoked the original one,
mm-hmm.
but most people don't use PKI, right?
You can't say that. Most people don't use revocation in PKI. That's a problem. Actually, the fault is at the browser side.
Okay, so can you explain what this revocation is all about?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So basically, if you've got a certificate, it is valid for some time, and if you want it to be invalid before the end of that period, you put it in what is called a CRL, a certificate revocation list. So you've got a list of certificates that have been revoked for some reason. You can put the reason there. The reason here would probably be key compromise because somebody else got your key now. And then this list is published typically at an HTTP URL or at an LDAP URL, and somebody can download it. And alternatively, there's a second form to do that. There's an online protocol, which is OCSP, the Online Certificate Status Protocol, where the browser can just go, or any client can just go and ask, I've got that certificate with the CL number so-and-so here, what's the status on that? And then the OCSP server can reply, oh, that's been revoked, or no, that's perfectly fine to our knowledge.
Okay, but most people don't do this, right?
That's true, because the default setting on the typical browser is not to check those CRLs in most forms. So it doesn't download the CRLs, and it doesn't do any OCSP. You can turn that on depending on your browser. So you can turn on OCSP, for example, in Firefox. You can't really turn on CRL loading in Firefox. You can only load that manually and import that into the browser, which is, I guess, nearly so nobody does that.
You have to manually import the revocations.
If you're not using OCSP, you'd have to do that manually. You can, of course, use OCSP, but not everybody who does certificates or every CA uses OCSP, so not every CA does have an OCSP server, and that has its own problem. So at the moment, if you're using Firefox, the best bet would be to turn on OCSP. But then if the OCSP server can't respond, for example, then you'll have a hard fail and you won't be able to connect to that site.
Okay, so you should do that definitely. Is it complicated to activate it in Firefox?
No, it's pretty easy. It's a bit hidden in the security settings, in the extended settings by the certificates, but you can actually activate that pretty easily.
Okay, do you know about other browsers like Microsoft Internet Explorer?
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, you can do CRL stuff. You can turn on CRL checking in Internet Explorer and in the newer browsers, so both in Firefox 3 and in IE7, only IE7 on Vista, that's going to get a lot better. So OCSP is turned on by default on both of the systems. Both of the browsers, so that is something that will get better in the future, and that is something that actually Mozilla, for example, is discussing right now how to deal with that. So if you read the Mozilla mailing list carefully, they're actually discussing how to deal with this whole situation and whether they are going to push forward Firefox 3 into the Firefox 2 update channel, or if they're going to turn on OCSP checking in Firefox 2 by default in an upcoming release or so. So they're actually thinking about it, but it's a pretty hard problem. You can't fix that if you haven't worked at it for quite a while, because it's a complicated situation and you'd have to deal with lots of exceptions. You'd probably want people to say, even though this check failed, I still want to access that site for some reason. And I said to you, for example, in Firefox 2, you can't do that at the moment.
So if I understand it correctly, at the moment, it's disabled everywhere.
Yeah, but by default, you don't have any CRL checking at the moment, I guess.
Is there any reason for that?
Well, CRL downloading is, of course, a huge burden on the server that publishes the CRLs. The CRLs are not that easy to fetch. You can, of course, cache them, but you have to have some code for that. I think Firefox, for example, doesn't have that. And then, of course, you'd introduce a lot of load on the CRL servers. And as for OCSP, well, I guess people just haven't implemented it that well so that you could use it out of the box. It's a bit better from the traffic, of course, because you only ask for one particular certificate, whereas in the CL case, you download a whole huge list that might include hundreds of certificates that have been revoked. So
there's a lot of research still going on. So I guess this is the first case where this feature is really needed.
Yeah. That's the good point, I guess, about it. I mean, of course, the situation is pretty awful there. The good point is that people have to think about our revocation for now, and not only in the browser case. Of course, there are other instances where that might be interesting. I mean, the people who do mail servers and do mail server protection there. And of course, I don't think anybody, any mail server implementation does revocation checking at that point if you don't throw the CLs at it manually. So all of those is pretty interesting. It introduces some other problems there, but still it helps for the PKI implementation in the end, I guess.
Yeah, so probably a lot of research is going to be funded in the near future in that area.
We'll see. I really know who would actually fund that research, because
VeriSign, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't think the CAs are too keen on actually on this issue.
So they profit more if they have to issue more, new certificates. Or
yeah, that was I was wondering about that as well, because I recently read something on the Mozilla bug tracker. So Heise is working on the issue as well, and we've had some contact with Heise and talked about some stuff with them. And they've posted at, or Jürgen Schmidt of Heise has posted at Mozilla bug tracker that they've actually talked to some of the CAs, so the major international CAs and some of the German ones. And apparently they've got statistics on how many users are affected, so they actually have been checking their certificates that they have issued. But they were saying to them that they won't really inform their users, so it is up to them. And people have been actually renewing their certificates. I guess most of the major sites probably have read that and have reacted on that. But there are still a lot of non-revoked certificates out there, and the revocation statistics are not very high compared to other months. So it's still... Yeah, if I was a CA, I'd say I'd inform my users. I don't really get why they don't. I mean, they could make money off it, sure. I can't see their reasoning why they do that.
Maybe they fear the users lose trust in the whole architecture.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's up to us to inform people.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have a last resort. This is the validity period of the certificate.
Yeah, yeah.
Certificates expire after a year or two?
Yeah, that depends on the CA, actually. So the one of the bank that I found unluckily only expires by 2011, so that it was one that was actually issued for 3 years. And of course, that's still some time until then. And I'd be interested in what the situation would be in regards to phishing and stuff like that.
Okay, so what this means is that as long as there is no PKI revocation enabled in the mainstream browsers, this vulnerability will affect this bank for 3 years approximately.
Yeah, probably. Depends on where it is still hidden. I mean, you don't know who generated their keys using Debian and didn't notice, and what kind of stuff has been happening in the past and where you've been using that and weren't really aware of that. So there might be some interesting cases where that already still pops up there. SSH being one of the cases as well. So if not only if you've been using authorized keys to access that, your keys have been broken, but even, well, if you've done any SSH connection with either a vulnerable client or a server, and somebody sniffed your traffic, then your whole session is broken. And of course, you might have entered some passwords there, either to authenticate in the SSH session or to authenticate to somewhere else, or your database password or something like that. So yeah, all of that might be considered, if you're reasonably paranoid, might be considered broken, and of course that's a problem there.
So does this mean when I logged into my machine from a Debian machine, even though I don't use public key authentication, they might have grabbed my session because Debian also uses or used insecure symmetrical keys?
It's not really about the symmetrical keys, it's actually all about the Diffie-Hellman exchange that takes
okay.
place at the start of an SSH session. So
the Diffie-Hellman was affected too?
Yeah, the problem there is, I don't know if probably we're losing some of the listeners there in the Diffie-Hellman stuff.
Yeah, let's not go into detail. But the thing is, if you ever used a Debian machine or a Ubuntu machine to log into your server, no matter if you use public key authentication or not, you should definitely change all your passwords.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I think we should stop here, play some more music to let people just grasp the impact of this vulnerability. Yeah, now I have Eric on the phone. Hi, Eric.
Good evening.
Yeah, and Eric will talk to Alex now about some more cryptographic aspects of this vulnerability.
Hi, Eric.
Good evening. So basically, when it comes to doing secret communications over an insecure channel, there's a very basic protocol which was invented more than 30 years ago. It's called the Diffie-Hellman protocol, and it's used in SSL and SSH.
Yeah, and that's of course pretty tricky if you're using that, because it largely depends on having a good random number source. So maybe Eric can explain a bit on how that actually works.
Yes, so from a non-mathematical view, you got two parties, and both want to have a common secret symmetric key, which means they will do some communications, and after that, both will know a secret, and an attacker who has listened to this communication won't know the secret.
Yeah, that's the point. And that's a pretty neat trick, I think. I mean, 30 years ago, people wouldn't have imagined that this is actually possible. So that's one of the cool things about cryptography, that you find stuff that people look at it and say, oh, you've got that public channel, but you can exchange a private key without anybody actually being able to figure out what that private key is. So it's a pretty neat feature there.
Yeah. From a mathematical point of view, what happens is that both parties need to agree on first a large prime, usually called P. When you use it today, you use the 1024-bit or 2048-bit prime, and a so-called generator G, which means that this generator will generate a group called ZB, which means that if you start to calculating generator raised to the power of 1, raised to the power of 2, raised to the power of 3, and so on, you will get all numbers between 1 and p minus 1. And there are some modified versions where you don't get a generator of the whole group, just a generator of a large subgroup or something like this, but basically that's it. So I won't talk about how to find out if a number is a generator of a group. It's usually not very difficult. Usually you got some preset parameters P and G. You will use new protocols. There are some IETF standards which specify some numbers which are good for this protocol.
Mm, and in SSH, they're actually saved on your server in the etc SSH moduli file. If you look at that, you will find the parameters in there for different key lengths. So for 1024 bit groups, there are about like 41 or so, I think, in there. And then the server just chooses one of them at random, and they are going to use that for the complete session then.
Yes, and these parameters can be completely public, and you don't need to hide anything here, or you are allowed to take these parameters from somehow trustworthy source. It's not like RSA, where you choose two prime numbers and multiply them and keep the prime number secret. So this is all public, this generator G and the prime P.
And in SSH, it's actually being sent. So the client sends, I'd like a group of that size, so it sets some bounds for the size, and then the server decides on the group and sends the group parameter to the client. So they're actually being sent out in the clear at that moment, because the session is not encrypted at that point.
Yes, and now what happens from the mathematical point of view, each party on both sides selects a random number between 1 and p minus 2, and usually both parties are called Alice and Bob, and this number of Alice is called small a, and the number of Bob is called small b. And what is important is to choose these numbers in a way that nobody can guess these numbers, because in the moment somebody was able to guess the number, then he can break the security of the protocol.
Yeah, and of course, that on a vulnerable Debian system, that is now a problem. So for the clients, I actually wrote a small script that checks that, so you can throw the PCAP file if you've captured some network traffic, and that looks at the file and looks at what the client sends to the server, and then you can just calculate it. If you've got a list of all possible private value, so the random value that you choose at that moment in the client, there will only be 32,000 or so of that, and then you can just calculate it, and it takes, I don't know, like 2 minutes or so to calculate 32,000 exponentiations that in the 1024-bit group. So that's pretty fast. You can even do that on the fly nearly. Then you can just recreate and find out what the secret value there was.
Yes. What's these parties to the communication are now doing? They're not sending out these random numbers. They are called, they calculate new numbers called big A and big B. And big A is the result of G raised to the power of small a modulus P. And big B is the result of G raised to the power of small b modulo P. And these numbers are exchanged, and from both these numbers, they can now calculate a common secret symmetry key.
Yeah. And that's where you can solve the problem if you've got a Debian environment system. So typically the mathematic problem that is in the background here is the discrete logarithm problem. So if you've got g to the small a, then you won't be able to solve that very easily to figure out what a is, even though if you know g and p. But of course, if you've only got 32,000 possible values for A, then you can just do trial exponentiation and do G to the first element in your list, to the second, and so on. And that works pretty fast. And then you can basically solve what is called the discrete logarithm at that point. And then you have the value small a, and then basically you know as much as the client. And then it should be clear that you should be able to read everything. You're in the same position as the client, basically, so you can decrypt the complete session, because the client can decrypt the complete session.
Yes, and this means if you get a vulnerable Debian system and you are using Diffie-Hellman key exchange, then an attacker will be able to decrypt this session. That means he will get one session key and will be able to decrypt all traffic in this session.
Hmm. And of course, maybe that was missed before when I was talking to Hatsi. The problem here is that, of course, many people like you and me, I guess, go to a conference and we don't just SSH into a box to read our mail. But of course, most of the people also set up their SSH tunnels at a conference, for example, and then basically all your traffic went through that SSH connection. And of course, that makes you think on who might be able to read that now.
Yes, but there is even a more worse thing in the Debian SSH bug.
Yeah.
Yes, because there are several ways to authenticate yourself. So Diffie-Hellman just describes how to agree on a common secret key mm-hmm. over an insecure channel. The next problem is both parties need to authenticate each other.
True.
Yes, and usually in SSH this is done using the DSA signature algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And this algorithm requires you to have a private key and a public key, and the private key is only stored on the server, or if a client is authenticated, it's only stored on the client, and both parties exchange their public keys and remember the public keys of the other party, and when they do a connection, then they have to sign some values so that the other party can be sure that the originating party has really the secret key and therefore is the right identity.
Yeah, and at that point another random value comes into play, I guess.
Yes, and the problem with DSA is as long as you are choosing good random values, then the protocol, then this algorithm is quite safe. But in the moment you are choosing one single random value in a bad way, which means that it's predictable by an attacker, then your whole secret key will be compromised.
Yeah. And of course, that's pretty bad there as well. But anyways, you'd have to replace your keys, being it both RSA and DSA anyway. So I don't know if that makes much of a difference in reality. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, there's a difference because this client identification, you usually use it on different systems. For example, if you get a laptop computer and you get a workstation at home, and you share the key between all the systems.
Okay.
And if the key was generated on a secure system and was used on a bad system, yeah, then without DSA, this just means an attacker would have been able to decrypt a single session.
Yeah.
But if you have used the DSA key and shared it among multiple hosts, and one of these had a bad pseudo-random number generator, then an attacker will be able to calculate the private key, yeah, from a signature and your public key and compromise all your security.
Yeah, that's the basic difference there between the RSA and the DSA keys. So the RSA keys are only compromised if you actually generated them on a Debian system. And for DSA, you wouldn't have to need it to generate it on a Debian system, but could have been generated on any kind of system. But if you've been using them on a Debian system, that's a problem. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I think this is the Rust thing here.
Yeah, I don't know how in practicality how often that actually happens, but still, yeah, it's a pretty bad issue because you'd have to think about it. I mean, people just think, okay, I haven't generated that on a Debian system, so I'll probably be secure. So that is something that can easily be missed. Yeah.
Yeah, and another problem is usually you might have decrypted a single session, but you might not have the credentials to log in to system, but if you have compromised one of these authorized keys to access the system, then you will be able to SSH into a server and execute any command you like.
Yeah, and of course, as we all know, that's really bad.
Yes.
Yeah. What else? I think you were on the mailing list that you've also scanned. If we go back to the SSL scenario, maybe for a bit, you've scanned a bit using nmap complete list. It's a bit long, I guess, but a few SSL web servers and have found some statistics on how many were affected there. And I found that quite interesting because I think there was a pretty large number there.
Yeah, I did a little scan on some SSL servers, and the result was that around 0.5% to 1% had bad keys, which means that you could calculate the private keys from the public keys or the certificates the server gives out to any client.
Hmm. Yeah, that's pretty bad, I guess. And if you look at it, I've scanned a bit myself, not really using nmap, but just inputting random websites that I found somewhere. And I found some, and I've actually notified some, so one of an open source project. And nobody really cared until now, so that's still vulnerable there. I'll be wondering on how long we see still vulnerable sites out there, so I guess that's going to be a long time. Because people don't really recognize that issue. I mean, they probably all changed their SSH keys by now, hopefully. I don't know about any ongoing SSH attacks there. But for the SSL part, I think people still mistake the issue there.
Yes, there was one interesting site, I think whitehouse.gov was affected.
Mm.
They had a bad SSL, and there were some other quite few sites there had bad SSL keys too.
Yeah.
And there is a little problem, because usually you can do sniffing something out of a Tor exit node or so, and you can write a proxy server, and the server will passively monitor the communication, and in the moment the server finds out that the other party has a vulnerable service certificate with the weak key he can crack, then he can go into the communication and do an immense middle attack so that nobody will notice it, because he can just transparently go into the connection and sometimes decrypt everything totally passively, or do an active immense middle attack in the communication,
yeah,
and know all the session keys.
Yeah, I guess that would be a pretty neat toy to have, such a man in the middle proxy, but I guess it would probably be forbidden under all weird German laws here. So actually I was looking into the SSH stuff, and I wrote the tool on purpose now that it only outputs that some session has been vulnerable at some point. and I can't really decrypt the SSH session. And I'd really would like to do that as an exercise, but I guess I can't really write that under our German laws, which is a shame, I guess. For the political part, maybe.
It's been very technical.
Yeah, I guess that's pretty much it, I guess.
Okay. So has anybody else questions about that?
The political part is a very, very nice Finnish sentence, and I would thank you, Eric, for the phone call, and also I want thank you, Alex, for your guest here, be a guest here in our studio.
You're welcome.
And now we want to play another nice song, this time from Iron Maiden. And after the song, we start to talk about some Rubik's Cubes.